I think I was about your age when I first went to Chhattisgarh to join the trade union. And I'll be very frank, I haven't had any further academic education after that. But I think I was quite educated while going through that movement. And so maybe in front of you, I can try and tell you the story of that trade union. Maybe that is another way to get educated. So, okay. So, recently, on 22nd January 2016, the contract workers of ACC Jamul had quite an unprecedented settlement with the Lafarge Holcim Company, and by means of which about 200 of them got what is called cement wage board, which is about four times the minimum wage and equal to regular workers, and another 200 of them got 50% of the wage board, and over the next 2 years a assurance of being regularized, and generally and even the third group which was remaining, who are supposed to be doing the unskilled work, also got a settlement for getting 25% above the minimum wages for doing the work they're doing. Now, actually, if you look at the situation of contract laborers today, things don't happen like this. Your wages don't suddenly go up from 7,000 rupees to 20,000 rupees, or even from 7,000 rupees to 11,000 rupees. So, question is, how did they do it? And while doing this, and because one thing that we are seeing, the time when I went to join the trade union movement there, that was 1991, that was the time when the whole liberalization storm was coming. And all these LPG policies which we're talking about, liberalization, privatization, globalization, then 1991 is the time when it all starts. And then, right in opposition to this tide, an entire contract workers movement starts building up in Bhilai. So, today, situations have become far more extreme than they were. 25 years down the line, things are far more extreme. We now hear that 60 people own more than 50% of the world's entire assets, properties. The differences between the wages of a CEO and the wages of a worker have gone up 10 times, 20 times from what they were 25 years ago. So, we are seeing things becoming very, very extreme. On the one hand, the companies are getting stronger and stronger. They're controlling governments. They're deciding on whether or not to have war. They're deciding everything now. On the other side, you have the contract workers. And if you think of what a minimum wage is today, these workers are not even being assured the minimum wage. In most of the places, you find them working not 8 hours, but 12 hours, and without overtime. So they're working 12 hours. They're getting less than minimum wages. They're doing the hardest work, the most unsafe work. How can those contract workers now hope to fight against these large companies? How are we going to do it? Particularly when we look at the situation now that a very small portion of them are trade unionized. Very small portion are unionized. So what was all this? How did this happen and this settlement? So it's more like a story. I'd like to tell it to you like a story, and then maybe when we discuss, then we can come to the more what can be generalized from it. So, in 1991, in Chhattisgarh, already when we went, there was already a different kind of trade union operating in Dalli Rajhara. There was a leader called Shankar Guhan Yogi. I don't think many of you in your generation would be knowing his name, but my older friends do. This year will be the 25th death anniversary of Shankar Guhan Yogi. He was murdered in 1991 on 28th September. He had a different kind of trade union altogether. What was the kind of trade union that he was envisaging? Now, we look at a trade union as something which raises demands for workers. It raises economic demands for workers. But Yogi's conception of what the workers were supposed to do was different. He didn't look upon them as just a lobby demanding something. Or as a group of people demanding something. He looked upon them, that these are the people who are actually creating everything with their own hands. I mean, you look around this room, there's nothing which is not created by workers. From your chairs to your video fit to all those instruments which are there. They are the ones who create things. They're the ones who make everything. And his notion was that these workers as a group have to also be the people who lead the society. And lead the society in the sense that they have that they are the ones who are going to create, forge larger solidarities with other working people and actually make really, because although we have given to ourselves a constitution long ago in 1950, and we have said that we will be equal and we will be free and we will have social justice, but actually bringing that to life means a big fight, and who's going to fight that fight? And his conception was that the working class of Chhattisgarh has to do that. And how did he go about it, or how did he think of it? Well, that was a union which was not just fighting for economic demands. Of course, it had to start with fighting economic demands, because survival is the first very important thing. And then this union, it had 17 departments. So it was not just the trade union. I think I don't need this. I'm quite loud enough as it is. But it's working. It had 17 departments. So it actually had a department for education. It started its own schools. It had a department for health. It had a department for savings, Bachat Vibhag. It had a Kisan Vibhag. It had a Mahila Vibhag, Sharab Bandi Vibhag. And actually the idea was that, see, these workers are, you know, they are going to become the center of some kind of a people's power. So if you have a power out there, which is the state, then you have a power out here, which is the people. And this is the way we are going to fight. So the flag was red and green. And that symbolized the unity of the workers and the peasants. And it had these 17 departments. And he used to say, ki, our union is not an 8-hour union. Our union is a 24-hour union. Because everybody will come, and as far as a worker's life goes, the union goes that far. So the union doesn't just work on your shop floor and for your bonus and for your wage revision, but it also works when you have fights in your community, when a husband drinks and beats up a wife, when you don't have a school to go to, when the officers are corrupt and they're not listening to you. So for everything, your union is there. And actually, this is what he made it, because people from all the surrounding villages started coming. The union would help them. And gradually, Chhattisgarh Mukti Morcha, which came out of the union began as Chhattisgarh Mind Shramik Sangh, that came about. And today, if you go to Delhi Rajhara, you'll see Shaheed Hospital, which has three operation theatres, and it has all the modern facilities at absolutely cheap rate. I mean, it is just at the cost price, and they're actually serving the community out there. The union had 11 schools, out of which 9 schools it gave back to the government. But it still runs 2 schools, because it says that the government should also remember that it was we who created them. And so on and so forth. Finding out the history, the local history of Veer Narayan Singh, who was an 1857 tribal leader of that time, generating that history. So many aspects of the worker's life was taken up in that. And with Veer Narayan Singh, he was still at that time when Niyogi ji brought forward his history, called a bandit in the Gazette, in the British Gazette. And then he was brought out as a hero, and then the days of his when he was executed, began being observed in Chhattisgarh and so on. So here is a real, there was an effort to actually holistically deal with the working class man and woman and child's life, and to make them have a sense of dignity, a sense of pride, to fight and to come together in solidarity. So the Chhattisgarh Mukti Morcha, whether it was Harda, whether it was Latur, whether it was the Bhopal gas cand, everywhere you find the CMM people, they have gone with their hospital, looking after people, giving solidarity, Narmada Bachao Andolan, or whether it was the attack on Gadar, the ballad singer of Andhra Pradesh. So everywhere you found this kind of solidarity and a whole conception that what was this leadership supposed to do? So the idea was ek naye Bharat ke liye naya Chhattisgarh, and a new Chhattisgarh for a new India, a democratic Chhattisgarh for a democratic India. Saying that Chhattisgarh is a place which is so well endowed with resources, why can those resources, why is it that we go on saying this is a rich land of poor people? How come those resources don't help in the poverty of people? How are they to be redistributed? How are we going to look at agriculture, where the majority of our people still are? How much, what is the proportion we are going to invest in industry and agriculture? These were the kinds of issues. How is water to be used? How are minerals to be extracted? All at one go, in one generation, and finish off, and then tomorrow go back sort of in a reverse reverse development situation. How are we going to cope with all these different issues? So anyway, so by 1999, Dalli Rajhara was an established place, and that was the first time the workers of Bhilai went to call Niyogi to come and organize workers in Bhilai. Now the situation in Bhilai was very different. In Dalli Rajhara, you had the iron ore miners. Initially, there were 50,000 of them. And they were mostly, a large number of them were Adivasis and Dalits from the surrounding areas. And those, and here you had the workers in the engineering industries who were relatively skilled, who were relatively educated, who were younger. And these were all the ancillaries and auxiliaries to the Bhilai steel plant, but where the conditions of work were terrible. There were 12, 14, 16 hours of work. It was very, I mean, in the name of personal officers, basically they were gundas who would see to it that no union is formed, that you can't ask for anything. And the illegal contract labor system, I mean, was functioning everywhere. And thus in 1991, a huge movement started in Bhilai. And the first parcha of that movement, I still remember, was Hazaro Nadiya Milke Samudra Banega. So people just came out of the factories together, and all over Bhilai, it is a bit like what you see, you're seeing in Gurgaon now, and which is being actually even more fiercely repressed. And people came out of these 16 factories and were on strike. And I remember at that time, jo billa laga ke gaye the, what was that billa, what was written on it? It said, Udyogpatiyon samay ki pukar ko pehchano. Samjhota ya sangharsh hum tayyar hai. Capitalists, look at the writing on the wall. You know, struggle or settlement. We are ready for both. So basically that was the mood in which people came out. And 4,200 people were just had the gates of the factories locked on them. 16 factories. And this whole group of people from that time when they were thrown out, which was Vishwakarma, 17 September, there was a huge rally. And after that, the gates were closed on them. After that, there were a large number of attacks on people, on different leaders, including on Niyogi. 28th September, he was shot dead while sleeping in his house from an open window. Even after that, the struggle continued. There was a rail roko agitation. 17 workers lost their lives in 1992. And then the matters went into the courts. I would say went into the tunnel of the court, because once it goes there, it never comes out. It goes on and on and on forever. So it was during that Bhilai movement, and which had actually challenged, what were the two main demands of the Bhilai movement, or the two main slogans? They were sthai udyog mein sthai mazdoor, where the industry is permanent, the worker must be permanent, which is so logical. And actually that is what contract labor abolition is all about. It doesn't work. I'll just tell you why it doesn't work. And the other was Jeene Layak Vetan, a living wage. So these were the two main demands, and these workers had come out. And after that, after a long struggle, they actually won court cases, saying that, well, their dismissal was illegal, so they should be taken back, but Rather than taking them back, we'll give them a compensation of 20,000 rupees. This was what was decided in the year 1999. And even that 20,000 rupees was not given. The different factory owners appealed those judgments in the High Court. And it is only last, in the month of May 2016, after 25 years, that those judgments have been given. And in those judgments, out of the 4,200 workers, not even 3%, not even 100 workers have been given, just 92 workers, I think, covering all the companies, have been given a sum of only 20,000 rupees. And all the rest have been denied that, saying, actually, what the judgment of the court had said while deciding to give them a compensation was that it is true that the workers, the union was not able to establish that these workers are the employees of the management. However, it was the management's case that they were contract workers. They didn't produce any contracts. They didn't produce any work orders. They didn't produce any records, any payment registers, any attendance registers. Therefore, they also did not prove their case, which was that they were contract workers. And therefore, I hold that since they couldn't prove their case, they were the workers of the management, and they have been illegally dismissed or dismissed without process, and they should be given. Now, the High Court has said, well, the burden of proof was on the workers. They haven't been able to prove their case. And so, sorry, after 25 years. So that is one lot of workers. There were thousands of workers who were fighting at that time. They did remarkable things. I mean, forget what they won and lost in their own case. But they did a lot of things. Once they came out on the streets, almost everywhere unions had to be formed. Almost everywhere, for some time, some kind of at least structure of labor, the department was visible that it existed, and there were unions and there were settlements and so on. So actually, by staying out, they really helped the workers of an entire generation. They showed solidarity with the peasants roundabout, and so on and so forth. But one of those factories was the ACC factory. Now, the ACC factory, the cement industry is somewhat different. And the cement industry is different because though most of the players in the cement industry are private, there was a time when the unions were very strong there. And therefore, in the cement industry, you have something called the Cement Wage Board. Now, what is it that the Cement Wage Board says? The Cement Wage Board says that in production in the cement industry, contract labor is abolished. That means you cannot have contract workers doing production process. And where is it permitted? It's only permitted in loading, unloading, and packing. And in that loading, unloading, and packing, you will have to give them the same wages as you give to regular workers. So that was a remarkable agreement that had happened in the 70s when the unions were very strong. By the time 1990-91 had come up, in ACC Jamul, actually, that was not happening at all. And what you had was, very few permanent workers, a large number of contract workers who were actually doing all the production work they should have been regular workers. They should have been getting regular wages or cement wages. They were not getting that. They were getting only minimum wages, and they were doing the production work. And so they raised this demand that they should be made regular and given Cement Wage Board wages. Okay? So they joined in the Bhilai struggle. Three workers of the ACC also lost their lives in the firing which happened. And then their matter went to the court. Their matter went to the court separately as a reference. And that is the time when we had to actually prove. And here, this is where I want to come to that. Why is it that contract labor doesn't get abolished even though you have an act to say that it should get abolished? If you look at the Contract Labor Act, it's Contract Labor Abolition and Regulation Act. And you read the preamble of the act, it basically says that you should abolish contract labor wherever possible, And where it is not possible, you should regulate it. So the emphasis was on abolition. Okay. Now, how is it to be abolished? How does the act ask you to abolish it? There's one way, which is that the government issues by notification that in such and such a work, no contract labor will be permitted in future. The simplest way, and it has been done, for example, sweeping in all central government offices. This job of sweeping and cleaning contract labor has been abolished. That means that you cannot employ contract labor there. So that is one way of doing it. The second way of doing it is there's supposed to be a contract labor advisory board, which, please find out, those of you who are interested, whether there's one in Maharashtra and if they've done anything at all in the last 20 years. So that contract labor advisory board, which contains some representatives of trade unions and some of the government and so on, you're supposed to give applications to it, and they consider those applications and they decide in which jobs contract labor should be abolished. And they abolish that. They don't do anything, of course. And what is the basis? The basis is if the work is permanent and perennial, if the work is a continuous work, if it is sufficient to have regular employees, then they should not be contract labor. Now, by that account, almost all work you see around you being done by contract workers should have actually been permanent work. Contract work should have abolished long, long ago. But it is not. And in fact, contract labor has become the bypass route to avoid all the labor laws. You have all the labor laws. You have the Minimum Wages Act. You have the Factory Act, which says that you should be given double overtime. You have the Maternity Benefit Act. You have the Equal Remuneration Act, which says men and women should be paid alike. In fact, our industrialists are forever complaining that we have too many laws and we have Inspector Raj and so on and so forth. But I assure you, none of these laws actually work on the ground. You still only get minimum wages when you fight for them. You don't get minimum wages very easily. So now, when all this was there, why was it that the contract labor wasn't getting abolished? Now, here is a nasty trick that the judiciary has played on the working class. And you see, for example, suppose there is a job in which the contract labor has been abolished. And I have been hired against that job as a contract worker. So what do I expect? I expect that I will go give an application and say, well, contract labor has been abolished in this job. I am doing this job, so please regularize me. So I should be regularized? Logical? Okay. So there was an Air India case. It's a very famous case called Air India. Actually, there were a number of cases bunched together in the Supreme Court, which said exactly this. It says, in a work in which contract labor has been abolished, if other workers are working there, they should be absorbed as regular workers. That makes sense, right? Now, that would have meant that overnight, lakhs of people would have become regular, permanent. So immediately, everybody rushed to the court. Everybody on the other side, of course, rushed to the court. And then you had this judgment called the sale judgment. Now, the sale judgment, what does that say? That says, if contract labor has been abolished in a particular job, and you are working against that job as contract labor, and you go and apply to the court, then the court is going to say, okay, there shouldn't have been contract labor here, so we'll abolish you also. We will abolish all of you, and we will bring out new notifications and new notices and interviews and recruit properly. You see, you have come through the back door. You have come through the back door. Now, who's going to tell them that the front door is never open? Which other door am I supposed to come by? Even in the government, we are only coming by the back door. There is no front door. There are no appointments. There are no vacant posts, they are saying now. And now almost everything is on contract. So this is what the sale judgment did. And effectively, it closed the door in the face of the contract workers. So now, even if contract work is abolished in your job, you better not go to the court. Because you will get abolished. So, and no idiot goes to a court to lose their job. So basically, this is what they did. So then what is the way out? There is only one way out now, which is that you prove that the contracts are sham and bogus. Sham and bogus means what? Sham and bogus means that actually the control is of the principal employer. He's the one who's appointing you. He's the one supervising you. He's the one who dismisses you, etc., etc. The contractor in the middle is only a paper arrangement. Or a camouflage, or there's so many words you can use, smoke screen and so on. So you're supposed to lift the corporate veil and find out the real relationship and say, okay, actually they are the workers of the employer. That is what we succeeded to do in the ACC case. And I can tell you one thing. I became a lawyer because those workers made me a lawyer. I was not a lawyer. I went at, as I said, around your age. I was 25 when I went and I worked as a trade unionist. And then they said, ki, didi, wo vakeel log waise bhi karte nahi hai jo karna hai. And then we never know which side they are on. So why don't you just become a lawyer? So I just became a lawyer. So having just become a lawyer and knowing nothing at all, but I had the advantage of being sitting right there among those workers. And I think this is one thing which lawyers and those of you who aspire to be lawyers or those of you who are lawyers should really think about. Nobody knows a case better than the client. All we know is how to put it into legal language. That's all we know. And we should understand that. So, you know, I used to be scratching my head and said, how do I prove sham and bogus? So they said, see, Didi, what was there was that since they were not supposed to have contracts in anything other than loading, unloading and packing. So every single contract was for loading, unloading and packing. Okay, every work order, every contract was for that. But actually what was the work they were doing? They were working the power plant, they were working in the coal handling plant, they were working in the gantry, they were working. So they were working everywhere, all over the company. But the work was being shown as this. So then they would tell me, you know, last year so-and-so worker died. And he was given compensation. So we have the proof of that. So then I had something. So I would cross-examine each contractor to bits and pieces and say, okay, so how did that man fall into the hopper? So he says, I don't know. He just went there. So how did he just go there? So this was the way. Slowly and slowly, we actually proved that these workers were actually working all over the plant. And they were doing production work. And however, they were... the contracts were all loading and packing. So this is the way that it got established that the contracts are sham and bogus. However, I'm telling you this in 10 minutes, but it took 6 years because the reference began in 2000 and it ended in 2006. And during the entire period between 2000 and 2006, every group of contract workers, one by one, they were being retrenched. And we actually fought and fought and said, look, cases that they are sham and bogus. So, just don't allow the ACC to make any changes in their conditions of service. And we got an order in our favor, but ACC would say, we're not doing it, is the contractors doing it. So these paper contractors who used to come on breakdown scooties and who didn't even have 5,000 rupees in their bank balance but were supposed to be running all these workers. These were the guys who were supposed to be retrenching people and so on and so forth. And at the end of the day, we started with 573 workers and 350 of them had been retrenched by the time we got the order. Well, so then what do we do? Then, of course, the magistrate said, no, but those people were, it was a coercion. They were all removed. Because how were they removed? They were simply removed by not giving them work. For 10 months, if you don't get work, what do you do? So you sign a VRS and get a little bit of money. So it was definitely not voluntary retirement as they showed. It was coercive retirement. And the magistrate realized that and he reinstated them and ordered them to be regularized. We said, okay, fine. We fought and fought. We went on strike. We said, please implement this judgment, so on and so forth. Nothing happened. They went to the High Court. So in the High Court, we struggled for another 5 years. 2011 now it has become. 2011, they say, these guys, they took their VRS with their eyes open. So, sorry, we can't do it for them. But for the remaining 120 odd, yes, they should be regularized. Now, you would think that by now, it's 2011, ACC company should give them regular jobs, na? They didn't give it. And in 2005, they were no longer ACC. By that time, they were Holcim. So, Holcim had taken over ACC, and now Holcim has left. Has merged with Lafarge. So Lafarge Holcim is the biggest cement manufacturer in the world. And if you tell me that they cannot afford to give people the wage of a permanent worker, you must be joking. They get 12% of their profits from this country. They already have in Chhattisgarh alone 4 or 5 plants. They want to set up 7 more. So obviously... And they're shutting their plants in America, in Spain. They're shutting down those plants. They're coming here because they're getting cheap labor. They're getting limestone. And they don't have to worry too much about pollution. The pollution control officer is their good friend. The collector is also their good friend. And the mining officer is also their good friend. And so is the labor officer their good friend. So everybody is their good friend. So they don't have to worry about anything. They can come here and make a lot of money. Now, so that was the situation. They were still not doing anything. So from 2011, we are again struggling. Then the ACC workers did something smart. And they didn't do it on their own. They did it because they managed to get the solidarity of global unions. The solidarity of the Union of Switzerland, the solidarity of Solifonds, which is a small group which helps fight against multinationals in Switzerland, and with the Industry All, which is a global union, which to which we got affiliated. And we raised a dispute with the OECD. So the OECD is a part of the UN, right? So and in different countries it functions in a different way, but basically if there is a multinational situated in a particular country, here the multinational was situated in Switzerland, they had their main office in Bern or wherever it was. So there, if you actually raise a dispute, then you can tell them that this company is not abiding by the guidelines for the multinational enterprises, which include that you shouldn't have bonded labor, you should have allow collective bargaining, you should not exploit communities, so on and so forth. You should abide by the laws of that particular land. And here we had two court judgments in our favor and nobody was listening to us. So we went to the OECD, and the OECD very politely said, well, you have to sit and talk to them. So for the first time in our lives, before that, the ACC company had never sat with us, never. They refused to recognize us. They said, oh, who are you? And our recognized union is the Permanent Workers Union, which is the Intok union, which is helping us to get VRS of you guys. So that's the union we talk to, we don't talk to you. And we don't know who you are. Of course, it was a little difficult to say that after we won two court judgments against them, but they had still not sat down with us. It was because of the OECD that we sat down, and for 2 years, we kept sitting down, 2014 to 2016. So then what happened? Then what happened was a combination of things. The Holcim company wanted to set up a new plant right next to the old plant. Now, the old plant had about 1,200 contract workers, some 300 permanent workers, and the new plant is a state-of-art plant. It is a plant which they wanted to run with just 90 workers, totally mechanized. And and they put crores and crores of money into it. So that is the time when we started our ground-level fight. We started preventing that new plant coming into. And we said, look, first you have to tell us what are you going to do with this old plant. We have court orders in our favor. We have people who've been working here for decades together. How are you going to rehabilitate them? How are you going to, re-employ them, redeploy them in the new plant? How do you plan to train them? How do you plan to enhance their skills? What are you going to do with them? So basically, on the one hand, it was the OECD pressure. It was the legal thing. But most importantly, it was the solidarity of the workers and the communities and the women who all, they began to understand that we are not going to be able to run this new plant unless we talk to this union. And so finally they said, okay, that number of 90, I mean, we pulled and we pulled and we pushed and we pulled and we brought that number up to 537. So 537 people today are employed in the new and the old plants, and out of which, as I said, 200 get the cement wage board, which is about 20,000 rupees now. Another 200 get half of that, around 11,000 rupees. And the rest get about 9,000 rupees. That is as far as their wages are concerned. After 2 years, we are hoping that about 400 of them will get regularized. And the ones who went, what happened with that? Now, that was really a very, very sad thing. And I know that those workers were not happy. We were not happy because It's very, very difficult. It's a cutthroat world out there where you don't even get minimum wages. And people who had been in the shelter of a union for some time, at least they knew that the union will fight when they're thrown out. The union will, you know, get their forms written, get their PF taken out, help them in so many different ways. Nobody wants to leave that and go away. But at least for them, again, we fought and we fought. And they got 3 months' wages for every year that they had worked. Which means that a total of something like 9.5 crores was given to 273 workers. It's a large sum of money. So on an average, they got about 2 lakhs of rupees. So that is something that we did manage to achieve. Now, I mean, and despite that, I'm still saying that it was not something we were happy about. Because we really have to think, do we really need such a highly mechanized plant at all? Do we, I mean, why are we spending crores and crores on the machinery? We have so many people. I mean, we really have to think back like Niyogi did about semi-mechanization in the Bhilai steel plant mines and so on. But here we see one thing, that why was this group able to sustain itself in these 25 years, and how was it able to fight in the court and in the street and in the OECD and go all the way to Switzerland? Two of our comrades actually, we, you know, the Unia actually paid them tickets. I mean, it's 35,000 rupees going one way. So to actually go and sit there in Bern with these hotshot CEOs, you can imagine what an experience it must have been for them. So, and the main thing about that is because actually our union was not only concentrating on this economic struggle. This union was actually helping other villagers around the anti-displacement struggle. It was working with families. It runs a school, a primary school, even in the Raipur Basti. There are so many things, and particularly the women. The women workers have been a real bulwark of this entire struggle. And it's interesting because, you know, in the traditional mold, many times, I mean, of course, there are women workers and there are women who are the wives of workers. And both these categories of women were actually coming out to fight. And many of the times you hear workers saying, "Arey, we want to go on strike, but our families pull us back." So they are always looked upon as a negative force, the families who say, "Khana kahan se aayega, don't go on strike, what will we do?" And they're supposed to be. But that is because you don't include them in your fight. And when the Mahila Mukti Mocha started getting organized, and they said, "Okay, fine. We are not just going to fight shoulder to shoulder with you. We'll fight ahead of you. But look, no drinking, no beating, no throwing out anybody from anybody's house. All this should stop. And then we are as big fighters as you and stronger than you." And they kept their word. They were very much a part of that fight. And presently in the Bastis, where we have our women's unions, the Bastis are actually run by women's committees. And those houses in the Bastis, of course, obviously they're not legal from the point of view of the government, but they have fought and they've got water and they've got electricity and they're running their school and their library and everything. So those places, actually they, the house is in the name of both. So, you know, you just can't say, "Get out of my house." It is not your house. It is my house also. And hang on, let me call the women's committee and they'll tell you whose house it is. So, you know, that is one of the reasons why these women have continued to stick on in those bastis, even sometimes when there has not been electricity or not been, you know, the amenities are not so good, but they prefer to be there because there is this larger solidarity to look after their world and their life. And the reason that I'm discussing all this here today is because I think this is a time when this old-fashioned working-class movement, we have to begin thinking about it again. There really, it is a time. You look at France, there have been lakhs of workers on the road. They are the ones who are ultimately going to tip what is going to happen with the European Union. You know that. You know what is happening in Greece, what is happening in Spain. I mean, USA, where the word socialism is like, sedition. You can't say the word socialism. You've actually got a man who almost made it. Almost. almost made it. So you've got people saying, oh, vote for Bernie Sanders, and people singing international in his meetings. What is happening all over the world? It's something to be thought about. Iraq. You know, no news is coming from Iraq now. But after years and years of wars and devastations, did you know that in Baghdad, 5 lakh people came out on the streets of the Iraqi Workers' Communist Party? And you know what are their demands? Stop sectarianism between Sunnis and Shias. Implement living wages. Stop the corruption in the government. Wow. So after all that, they are surviving, they are uniting, they're standing up again. So I think really the time has come. And we have to really think about the working class again, because, you know, for a long time, there was this honeymoon of capital and labor, and we said, theek hai, bahut badhiya hai, we're sitting at the table and we've got these labor laws and all that. But remember how the labor laws came. They came because actually there was so much of unrest, so much of labor unrest, it couldn't be managed. And that's how you agreed to labor laws coming in. And now you have violated them. You're not allowing them to happen. So I'm sorry, we're going to go back to the days of the wildcat strikes and the industrial unrest and the tool downs and the geraos, and because you're not letting people live, survive. And I think a big, very big sign of that is the general strikes which are happening. The general strikes which are happening, in which we, it is our observation that people are spontaneously joining the general strikes. Actually, the leadership is behind. The workers are surging ahead. And even if their leaders don't very much want a strike, they're saying, we'll go on strike anyway. So there you are. What we saw in Bangalore, these garment workers, you've seen it in your own city, right? The way they came out, I mean, what the central unions could not achieve by so much of negotiating at the table about the PF, they achieved. What we're seeing, the women of Munnar, what they're doing in Kerala. So I think we need to think about the working class once again, because I think there lies a hope of dignity, a hope of really a secular politics, a hope of fighting the people who really matter, the big corporates. And so I'd say that those of you who are studying, who are working on social movements, or who are interested in these issues, please think of looking in that direction again. And I'd like to invite you all to come on 28th September to Bhilai and meet workers who all participated in this struggle. Thank you.